Welcome to the LDN Radio Show, brought to you by the LDN Research Trust. I'm your host, Linda Elsiegood. I have an exciting lineup of guest speakers who are LDN experts in their field. We will be discussing low-dose naltrexone and its many uses in autoimmune diseases, cancers, etc. Thank you for joining us. Healthy Gut, Healthy You is Dr. Rushko's long-anticipated and comprehensive guide to completely resetting and healing the gut. Arm yourself with the education and tools to heal yourself from the inside out today. Visit drrusco.com for details. Today I'd like to welcome back my guest, Dr. Michael Rushko. Thank you for joining us today, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you're a speaker at the LDN 2019 conference in June in Portland, in Oregon. This is a pre-recorded radio show, so we've actually had the conference. Could you tell us about the presentation you're going to be giving at the conference?
Sure, I'd love to. You know, there's a growing problem in progressive thyroid care that I'm seeing at an alarmingly increasing rate, and I think it would really benefit providers of all stripes to better understand this. Essentially, there are maybe two or three big misses that are occurring in thyroid care. One is overdiagnosis of hypothyroidism, or you could term this another way, when someone isn't truly hypothyroid, but they're being offered thyroid medication as a support. What often happens is the patient doesn't realize that this is being used as a temporary support. The provider doesn't make that clear delineation. Hey, you're not true hypothyroid. Some of your levels look a little bit low, so we're going to give you this medication to try to improve your symptoms. They don't make that delineation. The patient stops seeing that provider, but they keep taking the medication. And now there are a fair number of patients who have been on medication for years that they don't really need to be on. And so without getting too far into details, that's one key component, and we can fill in some of the rationale and the facts there in a moment. But overdiagnosis of hypothyroidism in cases that are not truly hypothyroidism is becoming fairly endemic in functional medicine. And where the source of the problem is coming from, because of course clinicians are trying to help these patients, or I don't think anyone is overdiagnosing hypothyroidism with a malicious intent. I think we're all saying, well, here's a patient presenting with fatigue, depression, brain fog, constipation, dry hair, skin, nails, whatever it is. What can we do to help this patient? And I think what we can do to help these patients in part is better understand the importance of gut health. And there is documentation to show that various maladies in the gut can contribute to thyroid autoimmunity, can contribute to non-responsiveness and malabsorption of thyroid medication. And by addressing these things, we can finally see these patients respond who had otherwise been unresponsive. And sometimes it involves using no medication or even a reduction of the thyroid medication. So that's kind of the 30,000 foot view, and you know, happy to go into more detail on any of those points.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really interesting. I've met over the last few years many people with thyroid conditions, and they don't generally tend to reduce their medication until they're on LDN and find that it's more effective than it was before. But that was interesting, you saying, and I took it to mean less was more in some cases, that, you know, you don't need such a high level over time. How does that correlate to the gut? I know that a lot of people with thyroid conditions say that they improve greatly if they don't take gluten.
Mm-hmm.
What else should they be doing? You know, if you've got somebody, a lady who's got thyroid, or even a man who's got thyroid conditions, what do they need to do to try and get their gut health in the right place.
Sure, and you make a great point, which is a therapy like LDN, through its ability to positively modulate the immune system, can positively modulate the gut, and that could help with malabsorption that could be occurring because of a problem in the gut. So that's one area that is overlooked sometimes, where someone may have various digestive symptoms, and the clinician may not fully connect that those digestive symptoms indicate that the person is not adequately absorbing their thyroid medication, thus having inconsistent absorption. And this may account for some of the instability seen in TSH and T4 when tracking someone's levels. And there are some papers that are documenting this now, most namely in either H. pylori infection or those who have ulcers, showing that the treatment of H. pylori specifically can actually lead to a reduction of thyroid medication. And of course, as you noted, there are papers published in those who have celiac, who when they follow a gluten-free diet can reduce their thyroid medication dose. For most clinicians, you know, they're probably having their patients experiment with a gluten-free diet. So that is a great recommendation. It's probably not offering the clinician anything new that they haven't heard before, but looking into something like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or H. pylori, that may offer a benefit. And again, sometimes we attribute this to healing the thyroid, and my thinking, and this is more of my posit than this has been fully borne out by the research yet. But my thinking is, when you see a change in the need for thyroid medication, where someone actually needs less medication, that occurs over the course of a few months, that is almost for certain going to not be due to healing the thyroid gland, but more so due to improved absorption of the thyroid medication. And again, we see this in some of the H. pylori studies where patients were able to decrease their dose of medication. And we've published on our website a handful of case studies where we've been able to reduce, in some cases, as much as half someone's thyroid medication's dose. At the same time, the patient is losing weight in a positive direction, meaning they were a bit overweight and now they're at a healthier weight. They have better energy, better skin, less joint pain. And there's another parallel here that reinforces the same finding, which is using the liquid gel tab form of thyroid hormone known as thyrosint. And also some research has been performed showing that in patients who have been unable to obtain stability in TSH and T4 and or resolution of symptoms, using thyrosint actually is able to get many patients to a more stable TSH and T4 and improve their symptoms. And this is almost, again, for certain, because thyrosint being in a liquid gel tab is much more easily absorbed than some of your more traditional tablet forms. So that's just a couple ways in which the gut can directly impact the absorption of thyroid medication, which, again, I don't think is being given the amount of attention that it deserves. And I can say in clinical practice, that can be the difference between success and failure in some of these cases. And I'll just juxtapose that with sometimes the clinician is really floundering with, well, they're on levothyroxine, and maybe we need to add in some T3 Cytomel, or maybe we need to switch them to a desiccated, something like Armour or even WP Thyroid or Nature Thyroid or any one of these medications that's a T4, T3 combination. And that's not really what the cause of the problem is. The cause of the problem is inconsistent absorption. And that is oftentimes addressed by improving the diet, as you noted, with something like gluten-free, or if someone's already been gluten-free, then considering some type of dysbiotic or infectious issue in the gut can then be what improves the gut health and allows the patient to more consistently absorb the medication. And then their blood levels look better. And then their symptoms also look better.
Mm-hmm. So how do people know what their gut health is like? What are the symptoms?
And that can be one of the biggest challenges, because we're starting to learn that you can have, and actually some of the older celiac research has shown this for a while, that you can have an active inflammatory issue in the gut that only manifests extraintestinally, meaning you have no digestive symptoms, but you may have something like atopic dermatitis or depression or fatigue or joint pain. So one of the challenging things can be figuring out, is the gut the root cause of this problem? Because you may have no gut symptoms. Testing is oftentimes offered as a solution here, which it can be, but the testing is really, in my opinion, imperfect. There are a number of things that we can test for, but there's also a number of things where the testing still hasn't been fully mapped out yet. And just as one example, we know that small intestinal fungal overgrowth does exist. Satish Rao has published some research on this, but because doing essentially sample directly from the small intestine via an EGD is impractical, then that's not something that we can really readily assess in clinical practice. So someone could do a breath test for SIBO and a stool test, and a stool test for other types of bacterial and fungal dysbiosis. And that's a great start, but we still might be missing something like small intestinal fungal overgrowth. So in answer to your question, what can be used to help assess the health of someone's gut? Testing gives us a slice of information that can be helpful, but it doesn't give us all the information. And so the way I look at this is to consider taking steps to optimize your gut health kind of proactively, even if you don't have a diagnosis of H. pylori or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, consider taking those steps to proactively improve your gut health. If you've improved your diet, if you have a healthy lifestyle, but you're still not feeling optimally well, you're still not feeling optimally well, then I think it's a good idea at that point to just, again, proactively and almost more so empirically take steps to improve your gut health, because it can be challenging to get that definitive diagnosis on a lab test of various sorts.
Mm-hmm. And I've had people with thyroid conditions ask me questions about gut health, and they say, how do I know if I've got leaky gut? I've read that, you know, there are people that have leaky gut, and I seem to have the same kind of problems. What tests do you do for leaky gut? You mentioned
great,
the breath
test
there for SIBO.
Mm-hmm. Great question. And this is another area where the testing is really imperfect. So we just performed a comprehensive review of the literature, literally looking at every test in humans on the marker zonulin, which may be one of the better markers for assessing leaky gut. No marker really is perfect. Zonulin, again, that may be the best test now. And zonulin is a marker essentially of tight junction proteins in the gut, and can be assessed via blood or via stool. And it does correlate with various diseases like diabetes, metabolic syndrome, in some cases inflammatory bowel disease and IBS. So it does seem to correlate with diseases or symptoms, but not in every case. But where the argument falls apart a little bit more, unfortunately, is when we look at what happens to zonulin when we treat people. So when we put people on a healthy diet or on a probiotic or what have you, and this is where there's much more inconsistent findings with zonulin. There have been a few studies showing that in people with symptoms and with high zonulin, meaning leaky gut, they then improve their diet and see a drastic improvement in their symptoms, yet their zonulin gets either worse or stays the same. Now, to be fair, there's also studies showing that zonulin can improve after using something like a probiotic, But there's also studies showing that people will see no improvement in zonulin after taking a probiotic, even though their symptoms have improved. And this might be because zonulin, we thought, was measuring just zonulin, but now measures a whole family of like peptides. And I know this may be a little bit unpopular for me to say, that, you know, zonulin may not be quite fully ready for the, you know, routine clinical application, but there are some inconsistencies with testing leaky gut. So this is why I say testing gives us a slice, and it can be helpful, but we really cannot fully hang our hat on test results alone, because when you look at the data behind these tests, in many cases, what you see is the tests do not perform perfectly. They're only partially informative, and so the best test arguably for leaky gut would be zonulin, but it certainly is not something that I think is highly reliable. So it's one slice, but we also want to take the patient's symptoms into account. And so maybe to just paint a scenario here, if someone came in with rheumatoid arthritis and they wanted to know if their gut was contributing to that rheumatoid arthritis, or even their thyroid condition, what we could do is perform some testing. And that would be maybe one third of the data that informs how we're going to proceed. And if we find something on testing, like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or H. pylori, we can treat those. However, if the testing comes up negative, one still may want to consider a round of treatment. And this is where using things like herbal medicines and probiotics makes it's much more of a tenable approach, because these things I don't think require the same rationale as using something like an antibiotic or what have you. But treat the patient for a presumed imbalance in the gut and then monitor their symptoms. If their symptoms are improving, or if the dose required for the thyroid medication becomes more stable, or even they start to appear hyperthyroid, like they need less medication, then that tells you that you're on the right track. So, and again, I know it's easier if I were just to proclaim one or two tests to be the best and one or two markers, and that's the easy message I think we all want. But unfortunately, when you take that easy message into clinical practice, you get really confused. And if you take my message, which is a little bit more nuanced, albeit being a little bit more complicated, I think you'll see it really interfaces into the clinical practice more consistently and delivers better results.
Mm. Well, I mean, unfortunately, your stomach and your bowels, you can't see, can you? It's not like psoriasis on your hands or something. You can't see what's going on there. When I have spoken to doctors and asked, you know, what they think are the top four supplements that people should be taking, and probiotics is always number one that people should take. I mean, what kind of a probiotic would you suggest to patients who wanted to take that to improve their gut health?
That's a great question. And I would certainly agree that, and especially for someone who's trying to improve their gut health, then a probiotic is a fairly inexpensive intervention and very safe. And probiotics are even now showing to have some of these secondary health benefits. For example, one meta-analysis has documented improvement of mood. Other research has shown a small but significant ability to improve cholesterol, blood sugar, and even blood pressure. Again, the effect there is small, and I would say not clinically significant, but at least you're getting a small movement in a healthy direction. So I'm just trying to showcase here the neutrality or at least small side benefit of probiotics, rather than there being some downside we want to be, you know, careful about, guarding against. And we do know that probiotics can improve things like H. pylori and be synergistic with H. pylori antibiotics, and in my opinion may help to kind of reestablish a healthier balance of H. pylori colonization, and they can help to eradicate things like SIBO and intestinal fungal overgrowths. So certainly, and reduce leaky gut. So, you know, certainly there's a lot of benefit that we can attribute to probiotics. To your question, the more challenging thing, what probiotic do I use? And this is where I think both the clinician and the consumer are confronted with just a dizzying array of options in terms of the probiotic formulas out there. And one of the things I write about in my book is organizing probiotics into three different categories. And this greatly simplifies the landscape in probiotics. And when you read enough of the research on probiotics and you sift through enough of these meta-analyses that summarize the high-quality clinical trials, you start to see that we can break probiotics down really into technically four categories, but one category is hard to obtain, especially if you're in the U.S., so I typically just, for conversation, mention the three categories, which would be your category one is a blend of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium strains. Now, the exact formulas differ slightly from product to product, but the underlying and unifying theme is you will see the strains in the formula are predominated by various strains of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium. And so that'd be your category one. Your category two is just one strain typically, which is the healthy fungus Saccharomyces boulardii. And then your category three, you have typically anywhere from one to maybe five or six strains. And the most typical strain you'll see here is Bacillus. Bacillus coagulans, Bacillus subtilis, Bacillus lichenformis. And these are often known as your soil-based or spore-forming probiotics. And what I like to do with patients is have them use a moderate dose of all three of these, or in more sensitive cases, they will likely have reported some reactions to probiotics in the past. And what you want to, as a clinician, identify is what category do they seem to be reacting to? Because oftentimes people, let's say, are taking a category one probiotic. That's the most popular and common probiotic out there. They may have tried two or three or even four different probiotics, not realizing that each one was a category one, a category one, a category one, a category one. And so they come in and they say, I just can't do probiotics. I react really negatively. And that's where taking a quick history and seeing if they know the names of the probiotics, quickly looking them up and determining, okay, all of these were in fact category ones. So then you can have them start with category two and category three. And there are some patients, by just going through that exercise of having them try a probiotic category one at a time, you can pinpoint, that is a category that you react negatively to. Now we can use the other category or categories that you do tolerate, and then you can obtain that fairly impressive benefit that can be vectored by probiotics and help the patient navigate around that reaction that had been kind of thwarting their progress previously.
Mm. Well, the first time I wanted to buy some, I went into a Whole Food shop and they had rows and rows of probiotics, and some started at £10 and some went up to £50. And I was trying to read on the bottle what was in the £10 one, what was in the 50, what was everything in between. And I was just so bewildered by the end of it. And I asked for some help, and the young man didn't know either, really. So I just went for a middle-priced one to try it, to see what it was like. But you have to do your research. It's not easy to find out. It's a minefield, right, because there are so many things on the market, and some that are similar, like you were saying, category one, but they're still not the same price. You know, there can be – sometimes if it's a really well-known brand, I think you may pay more for the name as well.
Right, and so you make another fantastic point, and I apologize for not mentioning that. Sometimes I just jump right to, I guess, what the – clinician, the more so kind of experienced gut clinician is looking for, and I forget that some of these more fundamental pieces I shouldn't gloss over. So thank you so much for making that comment. And you're absolutely right, which is the quality of a probiotic does matter. We want to be careful not to think that more expensive automatically equates to better. Yes, and we also want to be careful that if something is drastically cheaper than others, then there may be some corner cutting that is occurring. And so there are things that you can look for. These can be, I think, challenging for consumers, also probably challenging for clinicians if you're not used to fact-checking these types of things, but you can look that a company is following good manufacturing practices and is also having third-party testing to ensure that their probiotic meets its label claims. And then also looking for companies that aren't using fillers that can be irritating, especially when we're talking about people who have sensitive guts. Some probiotics, this more so happens with cheaper probiotics, they're not very potent and they're kind of watered down with other fillers, like potentially excipients or things like prebiotics, which are significantly less expensive. And another way around this is just finding a couple companies that are fairly reputable and just trying to use the probiotics that fall into the category system I outlined from those reputable companies. That's quite a bit easier than just going into a health food store and trying to figure out, here's 15 different probiotics, which ones can I trust and which ones can I not?
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's the same in America as it is over here. I mean, supplements aren't regulated, so you can have labels that make claims of what's inside it, but they don't have to put a percentage. So if it's not following like pharmaceutical grade, where they can prove, as you were saying, what is actually in there is on, you know, on the label, it is reassuring to know that you have done the best you can to try and find out what is in the probiotic or supplements of any kind, because the layperson just wouldn't know. So trying to get a good manufacturer, that's what I'm trying to say, is really the starting point, in my opinion, as a consumer.
Yep,
someone
agreed.
That you can trust, because you can spend a fortune on the cheaper brands that, as you said before, might have fillers and all of this kind of thing, and actually not have that many ingredients that are actually going to help you. But, you know, if something is a quarter of the price, it's a waste of money if it's not going to work, isn't it? So sometimes you have to pay that bit more to make sure that you've got a product that is going to do what it says it's going to do.
No, fully agreed. I learned that with protein powders, where I was using a less expensive protein powder, and I noticed if I had more than a scoop of it, you know, you make your shake, and sometimes you put in one scoop, maybe sometimes you're a little more hungry, you want a thicker shake, so you put in maybe two or three scoops, and if I ever had more than one scoop, I would get bloated. And I later learned from one of my friends who owns his own manufacturing company that you have to really watch the companies for not putting excipients, which are powders that help the machines run more quickly. And he explained to me that he actually, when he was making his protein powder, he had to pay extra to have them not put the excipients in because the machines ran more slowly. So it is a legitimate thing, especially if you have a sensitive gut, just making sure that who you're getting your product from is, you know, cares about these things. And it may not be that a manufacturer is trying to do you harm, but they may be saying, well, we're trying to cater to a market that is very price sensitive, so we're going to use these excipients to cut down our costs. And I think, you know, in our circle, we're trying to provide these items that are most gut friendly and maybe a little bit more expensive, but, you know, I think that the customers that we're trying to appeal to understand that with that slight increase in expense, the quality would be worth it. And so, yeah, it is important to find a company who's going to be attentive to these things and make those tough decisions of making the product more expensive when it's really in the best interest of the consumer.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, what's your diet like, Michael?
I eat a loose paleo diet. I do eat quite a bit of dairy, and thankfully I have no problem with dairy, and mostly meat, vegetables, fish, and I don't eat much in the way of grains. I do have some rice. I do generally avoid gluten. I do notice if I eat too much gluten, I do have a problem, even though I think the healthcare consumer is told that everyone should avoid gluten, which I think is incorrect, and that's not bore out by what the best research on this topic has found. But essentially, lots of vegetables, meats, healthy fats, fish, and a moderate to kind of lower carb diet. So some gluten-free grains, but not a high amount. So kind of a moderate lower carb paleo diet with some dairy would maybe be the best label that we could put on it.
Mm-hmm. And some people say that they find diets of eliminating food really restrictive, and they will say, once I've started down that road of eliminating these foods, am I ever allowed to eat them again? So you were saying that sometimes you still have gluten, and you know when you've had it. So obviously you don't exclude it completely.
Right. And you make a great point, which is we want to be careful with diets, not to think that an elimination diet means you eliminate forever. Most elimination diets follow the pattern of cut out foods that could be a problem for a while, maybe a month, maybe 2 months. And then once you feel you're improved, then bring the foods that you cut out back in, kind of in a systematic manner where you're bringing maybe one or two in at a time, so you can identify what foods sit well with you and if any foods are triggers. And then it's not to say that because a food is a trigger, you can never have any, but you want to be a bit more judicious with how you use it. And that is really, in my opinion, a key distinction to draw, because what I see happening with patients is they become so scared of food, and they may have little to no reactivity, let's say, to gluten. So they can get away with having some on some occasions. Now, if you're noticing some reactions to gluten, would I recommend making it a dietary staple? Absolutely not, right? But there's also this ability to live in the world without being afraid. And this is where I think some of the hardline messaging on gluten is really damaging people from a psychological perspective, because now these people are at a restaurant with their friends, should be enjoying themselves, and they're worried. They're sitting there frantically worrying internally, trying to hide it behind a smile on their face about, is there gluten in the sauce here, or was and now again, there are some people who are exquisitely gluten sensitive and they have to operate like that. But I don't think that they would wish that on somebody else who, at worst, they may feel bloated for 45 minutes if they have some gluten. So, you know, practically, your level of avoidance should be requisite with your level of intolerance. And again, I know that the gluten-free, staunch advocates will take issue with that, but you have to weigh that against the psychological damage we do to people who don't have much of a physiological reaction, but are inculcated and feared into thinking that they will have massive damage if they have gluten. And now every day in their life, they have this baseline level of fear that is damaging their health. And so when you weigh these all out, I think it's clear to see that, yes, we want to identify gluten as being a problem in those that it is and help them avoid it as best they can. But in people that have little to no reactivity, they have some leeway, and we don't want to fear them into thinking that they have to eat like they have celiac disease.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we've come to the end. And where has the time gone? It's been amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure chatting. Time always flies when you're having fun, right?
Yes. Well, we'll have to have you back again. So thank you very much for having been my guest today.
Thank you again. It's been a pleasure.
Healthy Gut, Healthy You is Dr. Rushko's long-anticipated and comprehensive guide to completely resetting and healing the gut. Arm yourself with the education and tools to heal yourself from the inside out today. Visit drrusco.com for details. Any questions or comments you may have, please email me, Linda, L-I-N-D-A, at ldnrt.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciated your company. Until next time, stay safe and keep well.